Osiris.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
My name is Adrian Quesada. I am in Austin, Texas, and I'm trying to get better at my art form.
Would you consider yourself a songwriter first, a multi-instrumentalist first?
I would consider myself a producer first.
Because I know you grew up, you know, on the border between Mexico and the United States, and you put out this amazing Boleros Psychedelicos this year. You actually have two albums that are coming out in the same year. Between that and the Jaguar Sound, which is coming, do you feel like it is telling your entire story, like your almost multiple personalities in two records?
Not really, but close. I would say that these two are fairly representative of kind of my cultural story and my influences and where my head is at musically, but you know, by no means is it all inclusive. I definitely I've been pretty obsessed with art and music for all my life, so I, you know, there's still a million records I want to make that I haven't made.
Hey again, everybody. You're listening to The Show on the Road, the place where sonic explorers and audio adventurers come to meet their new favorite artists, their new favorite songwriters, band leaders, people that maybe have flown under the radar. And that's my job, to bring you new sounds that will change your life. And what my guest this week, Adrian Quesada, is doing is creating something that maybe you didn't know you need. A soundtrack to the movie that's going on right behind your eyelids. And what he's doing, creating beats and creating sonic tapestries with the group Black Pumas and with his solo work, with his Spanish language work, it is really remarkable, and I can't wait for you to hear his music. Because you know what? Music is the soundtrack to our days and our nights. And we do not appreciate the people making the music like we should. Well, you may say, Zach, of course you're going to say that. You're in a band that tours around. You want people to buy that music to support artists. Well, yeah, this is how artists and dads like me make a living. And Spotify is still paying their artists 0.003 to 0.005 cents per stream. 1,000 streams, you make $4. It's not enough. We need to change the system itself. If you really want to support an artist that you love, go to a show in person, tell a friend, get some of their records online. It really helps. Dust Bowl Revival at the Venice West in LA, December 18th. Okay, without further ado, here's Adrian Quesada. And obviously, a lot of folks first heard about you when Black Pumas went through the stratosphere these last few years. It's got to be kind of crazy when a project like that, which, you know, could be just a one-off in a way, almost takes over your whole life. I mean, you guys are the theme of the World Series. It's like this song, All My Colors, right, can fit into all these different places in American culture. You know, it's like, yeah, it's baseball fandom. It's, you know, Joe Biden's inauguration song. You know, it could be all these different things. What was it like seeing that song kind of just work its way throughout the culture?
You know, so that song was written by Eric, my partner in Pumas, over 10 years ago, which is the interesting part. But I think on one hand, it's wild and kind of interesting to see how so many people put their own meaning to it. But then on the other hand, I mean, that's just like, that's what a good song is. You know, everybody can get something out of it. And, you know, his inspiration for writing those words and everything was a little bit more abstract than I think what people are putting meaning to. But I think that's the cool thing about music, is you can kind of get what you want out of it. And we're seeing, I mean, that's just when the song is timeless, you know, you're seeing what you're seeing now, which is it works for sports, it works for inauguration, it works for uniting people, it works for inspiring people.
Has there been a really awkward commercial pitch that people have been trying to get that song in, like for diapers or something?
Not that they probably, I think the threshold for what reaches my ears and our ears is probably fairly low. So I don't know that anything like that has made it to me in particular. I have in the past seen some really kind of awkward pitches from advertising people, for sure, but not on that song. Not that I know.
It's like when Johnny Cash had to turn down $1 million, I think, in the 60s for Preparation H to use Ring of Fire as their, you know, forever theme song. He's like, I just, you know, I don't feel like I need that type of
I got a years, this was years ago, but I, my last name is Quesada, which a lot of people just know the word queso, cheese. And I had I don't remember if it was like Velveeta or some cheese company actually wanted me to do a whole commercial. It was a really good budget. It was one of those things where it was like, well, should I just sell myself out like that and pay the bills for a couple of years, or should I pass this, you know, turn this down? And it turned out, I'm really glad I turned it down. But yeah, it was this whole ad campaign based on like my last name with something with cheese.
What did your folks do when you were growing up?
Yeah, my dad had a trucking company. He used to be a truck driver, and then when I was born, him and his partner in the company, which were both drivers, they worked for my uncle, they bought two or three trucks, and he started a company that started the year I was born. So he had a trucking company all my life. I was, you know, that's a big border town industry, you know, kind of import-export and trucks and custom brokers and things. And my mom had a clothing store. She had a clothing store in Laredo, Texas, and her family was also somewhat involved in custom brokering along the border.
Were you listening to mostly Spanish language music as a kid, or all sorts of stuff?
No, I was not. I mean, I on my own, no. You know, there was obviously growing up down there, it's completely bilingual. I just read a stat that Laredo is the least diverse big city in the country. It's like 97% I hate to use the word Hispanic, but Hispanic. And you grow up just hearing Spanish and Spanish language radio and music in Spanish. But no, I mean, I was, you know, I was listening to hip hop and rock and roll and hair metal and grunge or whatever and all that. So no, I was like by choice not not listening to Spanish language music. It was something I didn't really come to appreciate until I was older.
Your album Jaguar Sound comes out mid-November. There's still another month left in this year. You could put out a third album of hair metal songs.
Hey man, it hasn't gone past me. That was a influential sound in my formative years.
Who is your go-to band?
I mean, everything from Rat and like Poison and all that, but I mean, I was into the first Guns N' Roses album. That's my barometer for they had big hair and they were still awesome, and that album stood the test of time. But no man, that was when I was just starting to want to play guitar. It was around that era.
Did you play electric first or acoustic?
I started with acoustic. So my dad actually wanted me to play piano. And I was 13 or something and skateboarding. And it was like piano was the dumbest. Like, man, I was embarrassed to tell people I was going to play piano. And it's kind of one of the regrets I have. And one of my few regrets in life is that I didn't start with piano. But I was like, he kind of pushed me for a while. And I finally compromised. I was like, well, guitar looks cool, you know. That looks a lot cooler than playing the piano. So started taking guitar lessons. But instead of signing me, you know, instead of going and learning like tablature, heavy riffs, they actually put me in flamenco and classical lessons. So I did those lessons for a few years. And I'm glad I had that background, honestly. So I started, my first guitar was an acoustic guitar, actually, like a classical guitar.
Yeah, like one day, Boleros Psychedelicos
will
come out of this.
Exactly.
Do you feel like, as a producer, as a songwriter, as a multi-instrumentalist, that you're almost creating movie soundtracks for movies that don't exist yet? That's like what I hear when I listen to a lot of your solo stuff. It's like movies that are yet to be, but could exist if we wanted them to.
Absolutely, man. Well, you hit it on the head. Because I'm not a lyricist and I'm not. Vocals are not the first thing I gravitate to in songs. But there are certain things, you know, certain hip hop things. But I mean, really, I've always been attracted to the music behind it. And I always liked albums. I was an only child. So I was by myself a lot and had a lot of time to sit there and draw and listen. I loved albums and how they told stories, you know, which is somewhat of a lost art because of the, you know, streaming algorithm. But I used to hear them from start to finish. That's just how they were intended to be told. So I always imagined them like little movies. And I mean that the amazing thing about instrumental music is if you can make people visualize things without words, then that's kind of a powerful thing to be able to do with music.
Yeah, I mean, a song like Mentiras con Cariño, you know, it's got over 1.5 million streams. It's a song that people... are going to hear first if they go to your, you know, page now, which is really cool. People don't realize in this country how dominant Spanish language music is in the world culture.
I think I like to hear people's stories that they want to tell, because I'm not the best storyteller or anything like that, you know, but there are certain things with, you know, there is a poetry to the Spanish language that I think gets lost if you try to translate certain things to English. And you know, we're one of the only countries that's not really like proudly bilingual, you know, around the world. And I kind of, the older I get, I find a little bit more of a responsibility to challenge that or just make people embrace that, you know, how amazing it is to be able to speak two languages and how beautiful that the poetry in Spanish lyrics is. And, you know, that's, my story is not unique by any means, but, I think, you know, with all the division we saw in the last 4 or 5 years and continue to see, I think it's important to show people the more we have in common and how to be open-minded to other people's culture and you know, whatever I can do musically to make that comfortable for people is I find myself to having a little bit of a responsibility. You know, it's not like my music is going to change the world like that, but if I can, you know, if I can make it okay for a few people to enjoy it, then it's my doing my part. De ser un querer se convirtió en lo opuesto. Tu oleaje fatal buscaba destruirme y pude escapar sin llegar a hundirme.
Yeah, I was able to have Gabby Moreno on this show few years back, and I love the way she can kind of intersect all these different cultures in her music, you know, especially her record she did with the Daptone folks in New York. It's like this deeply soul groove vibe, but she's singing in these bolero styles, and it just feels like a perfect synergy. You're like, why didn't we ever do this before, you know?
Absolutely, man. That's a great one. And she's amazing. And yeah, there's, like I said, we have more, there's more in common than you think between people. I guess because of my upbringing, I don't really see a lot of those divisions in things, you know, like it's not that big a deal to me to hear a Spanish song and then hear an English song. It's not that. And I mean, honestly, even just without speaking on a language, musically, like rhythmically, the commonalities between rock, certain rock and roll and hip hop and soul and funk and music from Africa, it's all like the same rhythms. We're you know, I mean, without sounding like too cliche on like music being the universal language, etc., it is, and shows you how much we have in common. It's just about labels and what people choose to put in a box and label and it just causes more divisions. And I think it causes, you know, building bridges versus building walls, you know.
There's something about that track, Spirits, off the new record, Jaguar Sound, that reminded me of that Gabby Moreno Daptone collab. You know, you have the horns and you get that kind of flute dancing around. It's like if that brass band, marching band that Beyonce used, like got in the studio with you. You know, just like when you add the brass, it feels like something big is about to like go down, you know, like you're again setting up this scene for some movie that doesn't exist, between like a showdown is about to happen. What do you see when Spirits comes on for you?
So I was in a band for a long time in a big, Latin band called Grupo Fantasma, and we had a horn section. It was a fairly large band, over 10 people most of the time, fluctuating between 9 and 11 or 12 people. And we had a big horn section and stuff, and I did that for, you know, I was in that band for almost 13 years. So after that, I kind of, just because I didn't want to repeat, you know, what I had been doing and be, to a certain extent, you know, there's a lot of music now, or there was, you know, particularly starting more years ago, but a lot of these like kind of revival bands that were bringing back these old sounds and stuff, and they all had horn sections. So I kind of originally had this aversion coming from Grupo Fantasma. I mean, horns are amazing. It's incredible. I was lucky to work with that horn section forever and ever. But I just kind of needed to step away from that and not be kept in that box. So I had like an aversion to it at first, but when I was working on Jaguar Sound, I needed some melodic content, and that one is just so epic. Like you said, it just feels like you're about to march into some battle or something, and that's when, you know, that's when horns definitely come in and just elevate things, make everything super epic and cinematic. So yeah, my friends from a band called Ikebe Shakedown, and my friend who are in New York City, also affiliated with the Daptone circle, and my friend Martin Perna, who plays flute, I did a project with him back in the day, also from the Daptone camp, so definitely has a little connection to that world. They that album was being done when everybody was fully actually quarantined. This was like April 2020 when we were wiping down groceries and like not leaving the house, and so it was just whoever had a recording set up at home or was able to get into a studio, I was just staying in touch with all my friends that would do that, and we were all collaborating on stuff. It was kind of an awesome time, you know. It was all just out of necessity.
It is weird to say that I think we might look back at parts of 2020 years from now. Obviously, if you didn't lose someone, you know, but we might look back at it as this sort of almost nostalgic, like warm togetherness time, you know, where you could kind of have the pressure off, where it's like, well, you know what? We don't even know if we're going to make it through this year as a society, but like, let's make some new music that we've never tried before, you know, in ways that we've never tried before. And I think a lot of amazing art has come out of that. What was your experience during the darkest times there? Were you sort of locked in Austin, or where were you set up?
Yeah, definitely in Austin. Luckily my studio was at home at that time. I moved out into a bigger space, you know, about midway through 2020, but I was at home and luckily I had a studio there. You know, everybody was picking up hobbies and making bread and whatever, and I was just making jams. I would just stay up all night long. All of a sudden I didn't have to wake up at any time, to no obligations, you know. All my calendar was completely cleared, and I was so inspired the first couple of months. I was just like completely on fire every night, knocking out stuff. And then I hit a wall all of a sudden. I remember reading about, you know, Shakespeare had written a lot of his best works during a quarantine period.
Yeah.
And then I read this other article that was kind of a rebuttal, like, well, we can't all, you know, expect to be super inspired during this time, because it's a really dark time. And it also put some context to it. He also had, you know, all these wealthy sponsors and donors, and his bills were all paid. And, but then, so I kind of hit this like dark point where all of a sudden, you know, we all start questioning, is this the end of the world? Is this how we die, all in isolation? Is this what's going to happen? Are we going to get COVID and all that? You know, it's like, is the world just going to become extinct during this year? And then I found that I actually turned back to working on music, because that's kind of what was getting me through it. You know,
right.
I started with this, like, being on fire and super excited and having fun with it, to like, man, I needed that escape to process kind of what was happening at that time. It got kind of intense there mid-year, you know.
It's funny because obviously the song is much before the pandemic reared its head, but when I was re-listening to Black Moon Rising, it feels like something that could have hearkened that time. You know, this ominous thing is rising in the East, and we're all kind of like shaking, trying to figure out what is about to happen. That song, though, it feels like you're creating something. It's like a sound in that sort of deep soul meets spaghetti Western vibes, you know, like there's this, that echo you have on the guitar amp, where it feels like you're referencing the Italian Morricone scores, which I know you love. Did the Black Pumas project like create a new genre or something? Like, do you feel like you created something in that you didn't even expect?
I think we created a unique sound. You know, there were people like you mentioned, Daptone, and, you know, everything that the Daptone label did, and a lot of other artists who broke down the doors and made it to where people wanted to listen to soul music again that wasn't, you know, super modern R&B, that had a more timeless feel to it. So there were a lot of people that opened a lot of doors for that. But I think we came up with a pretty unique sound. You know, I don't know that it's a genre, or that other people are following that lead. But yeah, I mean, it sounds like, when you hear a Black Pumas song, it sounds like Black Pumas for sure. The only time she gets dressed in black, take it flight, baby, count you down. On your way off without a sound. Black moon rising above the clouds, your sunshine.
track Rise of the Have-Nots on the new record. If we're going into that theme of you creating these cinematic moments of something that maybe doesn't exist, I felt like that was like an animation, like a Miyazaki, you know? Like there's, I saw like a spider or something, you know? Like there's this sort of creeping and then stabbing, you know, the drums. And yet the bass has like a Steely Dan vibe for me. Am I wrong?
Well, you know,
Miyazaki and Steely Dan and coming Steely together Dan. Somehow.
I have not been a big fan of Steely Dan, not because I'm not a fan, just I just have not listened to a lot of Steely Dan. But I, you know, those musicians, all the people that played on those albums, were I'm fans of and other stuff. So, but yeah, the animation kind of thing was definitely something I imagined for that whole album. The visuals and everything that's going to be coming out in some of these like little visualizer videos and stuff is all inspired by Weird. A lot of it was, I don't know if you're familiar with the, it was this French movie from the early 70s that had this awesome soundtrack. It was called Fantastic Planet.
Mm.
Kind of just weird, trippy early 70s animations, you know, were definitely a big part of it. I definitely imagined a lot of that.
If you could collaborate with a hip-hop producer or an artist, living or dead, who would it be?
Just one?
Okay, maybe a couple. Okay, maybe it's like a whole squad.
To make it easy and practical, I would say Beck would be one that I think was a big influence on me and kind of at the intersection of a lot of stuff that I liked. You know, from he was doing everything from kind of like hip hop influence music to weirdo kind of like folk music to R&B to rock and roll. He was an artist, and I just heard a whole podcast where he kind of like narrates his own story, and pretty fascinating. So I would say he's one that seems a little like a practical answer. You know, I could say my super group of George Harrison and you know, whatever, but I think that's a practical good answer for you.
Maybe a little Tribe Called Quest
of
mixed
course.
In.
Yeah. I mean, I'd put together a large super group.
Did that touring whirlwind, I would say, that Black Pumas got swept in on, was it exhausting? Was it exhilarating? Like, was it relentless?
Mostly exhilarating. All those words are all good. It was kind of rejuvenating in a way to, you know, I had been trying to get off the road and be more in the studio and be more at home and everything. And you know, being on tour with Pumas was super inspiring. That the band was amazing. Obviously Eric as a front man. So those right away, it was like, oh wow, this is kind of another level of performing and being on stage and touring, you know, in the early days, where it kind of inspired me again to actually embrace it, you know. And I remember talking to a couple of people who've been around in the industry for a long time, and you know, I heard everything. Somebody who said, you know, to being able to do that is a gift. It's a blessing to be able to go, and you can't complain about the fact that you're traveling around the world and people are coming to see you play. And you know, you don't know if you're ever going to get that chance again. And you know, that was definitely the dream when I was a kid, was looking at MTV and seeing rock stars on stage and all that. So that was
right,
what I wanted to do. But then, you know, real life sets in as you get older and have kids and a family. It's kind of hard to balance both, but it was, I would say, overall exhilarating for sure. It was quite amazing to see how fast the touring took off and then also went away during the pandemic.
Well, considering that, you know, you guys got your kind of base started at C-Boy's Heart and Soul, you know, in Congress there in Austin, which is a tiny little club, you know, the juxtaposition from playing these intimate shows to, you know, playing the biggest venues in the world. I mean, it's got to be almost like a whiplash situation.
Yeah, it happened so, you know, everything was moving so fast that we just never really had a chance to. The pandemic gave us the first a bit of perspective to kind of soak it all in, you know, because I think in a way that was really good for us because, you know, again, we were at, like you said, we were at Seaboys, and then all of a sudden we were hitting the road and the crowds were just doubling and tripling every time we went back somewhere. But then we just never had a chance to pause. It was like we were just constantly on the road, and then the pandemic was a good time for perspective, you know, and then we started doing live streams and whatnot. And it was the first time that, you know, like I said, most people who I've done music with know that I'm kind of a studio rat and a homebody. Mm-hmm. And after doing a bunch of live streams and whatnot, I was like, man, this is just not the same. It's not. And then the first time we got to play to people was such a rush. And I remembered what a blessing it is to be able to do that, and gave me such good perspective on it. You know, I'll never take touring for granted again.
For those of you who are busking in the street, maybe down at the Santa Monica Pier, like Eric was doing, you too can make the big time if you just keep mm-hmm. going. I mean, it's a crazy story. I mean, how you guys were connected. Is Eric itching to kind of get back out there, or is he okay with the hiatus?
I don't know. You kind of have to ask him. I know he loves performing and he loves being out there. So
the moment that you realized that that project was going to be bigger than anything you could have imagined, like, what was that? Was it like standing on which stage where you're like, how is this possible?
A lot of things happened so fast that I don't remember an exact moment, but I do remember the feeling of our first show at Seaboys. I remember stepping off stage and being like, wow, okay, this is special for sure. I remember sitting down for lunch with Eric around that time and asking him, like, are you, cause you know, we weren't really a band. We just came up with a name and played some shows. And I asked him if he, was down, you know, to move forward with it. Cause I'm like, this is going to happen really fast and happen even faster than you can imagine.
When a band like that starts to spread among other bands, right? I remember our group Dust Bowl Revival, that song Fire came on, like it was like passed around like a, you know, like a trading card, you know, like there's something here. Like we have to do something like this, you know, like it was something that you could hear trickling to the surface accidentally, you know, St. Paul and the Broken Bones, this idea of, yeah, like a lost soul R&B movement that was now coming from these younger folks. The thing that I would love to see eventually is like having the Black Pumas like at the Hollywood Bowl with like a full orchestra, you know, because you could hear the string sections that you put in sometimes, you know, maybe sampled or not, you know, these cinematic moments. Like I'd love to see a fireworks show and the LA Philharmonic behind the Black Pumas. Just one time.
It'd be cool.
Have something that you're working on now that is a totally different sound that we haven't heard yet?
Always. And just right before I got on with you, working on new music now. I'm always I'm always juggling four or five things, cooking on, you know, four burners, and then once one starts to kind of come into focus a little bit, I'll kind of turn down the other ones and hone in on that. But yeah, I'm definitely working right now with revisiting more of, you know, when I started to get into recording and I started with samplers, actually. Like when I was in college, I bought an MPC 2000 and a sequencer sampler and was doing a lot of that. But in the last, 10 years or so, I was really embracing trying to get drums to sound like, they were the drums that were being sampled. So, like you mentioned the Pumas record and sample, there were no samples. We did that. Everything was recorded live. And I mean, not all live at once, but everything was live instruments. And I got really into making drums sound like the drums I used to like to sample. And now I'm just I'm at a point where I'm fully embracing and kind of best of both worlds and playing with more sound manipulation. It was a lot of the, like the Boletos album, the Jaguar Sound, Puma's record are all something that you can interpret live naturally. And it would feel supernatural with a band. Very, very natural, not supernatural, not ghostly. And it could be performed live and it all sounds live. It all sounds like real instruments. And right now I'm kind of messing with the idea of just more sound manipulation and not worrying so much about how do you perform this live, which I'm sure is not something my manager wants to hear, is that I'm complicating things even further. But that's what I'm working on musically right now.
The track Noble Metals on the new record, I was trying to count how many synth tones I heard. It was almost like four or five different keyboard sounds going on, and it has this sort of mystical, like a rave down in Tulum or something, and actually for some reason reminded me of some of the earliest like Santana records, where you have like a lot of smoke in the room, and people spinning around. It just felt really groovy. How did that song get created?
So it started during the pandemic. And like I said, those first couple of months I was making a lot of hip hop beats because I was listening to so much hip hop music because that's what I could do by myself. It was like just a good exercise. And also I could do all that alone. And then I started sending it to friends who started to bring it, the music, more alive and turn them into actual songs. But that one was pretty simple. And honestly, a lot of it is this cat, a lot of the one or two of those keyboards that you're talking about is just this little Casio keyboard that I have that I bought a few years ago. And I try to be good about putting new instruments in front of me because there's muscle memory to it, as I'm sure like if I pick up the same guitar every single day and try to write something, my brain and my muscles are so used to doing what I'm doing, something that like you end up kind of doing the same thing a lot. I have to like practice exercises to break me out of that and not repeat myself and write the same thing over and over. So one thing that's super helpful is just putting a new instrument in front of you, especially something like keyboards that I'm not great at. I have to fumble around a little bit. It makes my hands do new combinations of things. And I had this little Casio and I love the limitations of it. And the sounds were so just kind of out there. So yeah, it was mostly just this little Casio keyboard. But yeah, you mentioned Santana, and actually just the other day, I mean, I listened to so much Carlos Santana when I was, learning to play guitar, and was such a big fan of the early work that I heard it to death. I mean, I just almost like couldn't listen to it. Similar to, certain like Led Zeppelin and the Beatles and stuff like that. Yeah. It was like, I've heard it so much that it almost to me started to get old. But just the other day I was driving and some stuff came on the radio. Like, man, like it's so incredible. So such a like amazing, unique musical moment of all these things he was putting together that I relate to a lot, culturally, what he was doing.
His organ player, I think, is one of the most impressive instrumentalists of that time. I forget what his name is, but he's crushing it.
Probably maybe Greg Raleigh, I think, was playing on that stuff. who lives in Austin? He lives here in Austin now. Yeah, man, it adds so much vibe, so much mood to it.
Where do you see yourself like 20 years from now? Like, what would be your ideal situation?
Oh, man, 20 years from now, hopefully slowing down a little bit and soaking things in more. You know, I kind of have an obsessive work ethic that, like, and you have to, like, literally yank me away onto into vacation mode and leave gear behind, or I'm going to continue to, like, get inspired by everything around me. So, like, I, as much as I love working, I love not working, but I just, like, my instinct every day is just hardwired to, like, wake up and go to work. I just can't stop. And I love, but also doesn't suck when you get to do music. You know, I love doing this. It's like my favorite thing to do, but I think it's important to stop and just savor the rest of what life has to offer. So hopefully, you know, in 20 years, I'll have be at a point where I can savor things a little bit more and be less of a psycho about working on music.
You have kids?
I do. Yeah. Two kids.
Do you have them collaborate yet with dad?
Not quite yet. Not quite yet. We did during the pandemic. Actually, I would jam with them. They would play bass and keys and sing, and I would play drums. And we did jam for a little bit during the pandemic.
My little one is obsessed with music. Obviously, she's in my genetic bloodline, but she does this thing where she shakes her head back and forth, almost like Stevie Wonder. It's like her go-to move. Mm-hmm. She's been in basically the last several music videos that we've done, you know, partially because it's she's so cute. Like, how are we not going to put her in this video? And I'm like, she's not giving consent to be a social media star at this point, but she's more popular than I am at this point. So, you know, she's part of the family business, I guess, you know.
Yeah. Hopefully she gets some money out of that later in life.
Yeah. When you make a beat, what is the first thing you start with? Do you try to find like a reverb tone? Do you try to find a
mostly
hit?
Mostly drums. I try to change it up, but the thing that gets an idea going the most is some cool sounding drums. Is what I always, you know, I'll try to start on an instrument here and there, but I mean, it's like finding a cool drum pattern, a cool drum loop or something to write to is just like, I lock into everything that a drum beat is doing. That's kind of where most of my ideas start.
How has your library been collected? Like, where are you drawing from?
Oh, it's all over the place. Everything from vinyl to a lot of it is just really digital. I have so many friends that do music that, you know, have plugged in their hard drive and I've plugged in my hard drive, and we've just traded libraries and libraries of sounds. And during the pandemic, just discovered, you know, all these amazing contemporary producers doing these really cool sound libraries and drum libraries and whatnot, and tapping into that resource, you know, which I didn't even know that world existed, to tell you the truth, but I've kind of dove into the deep end with all that.
All right, last question. Any movie from history, they're going to remake the soundtrack, you get to be the musical director. Which movie would it be?
I'd say that same French animation I was telling you about, Fantastic Planet.
Hmm.
Speak it into existence.
All right, man. Well, I'm so glad you could come on here. And Jaguar Sound is really cool. And
thank you, man.
I look forward to seeing what you got in store.
Awesome. Appreciate it, man.
Big thanks to Adrian Quesada for getting on the line from Austin with me. And you can go to adriancasada.net for his newest record. It's called Jaguar Sound. It just came out, and it's on ATO Records. Also, Boleros Psychedelicos can be found there, too, if you want some Spanish language goodness in your life, which you definitely do. I try to make a point on my new radio show on 88.5 FM, the SoCal Sound in LA, to always put some Spanish language or a different type of music on there that people may not experience on mainstream American radio. We have a new time, 7 a.m. on Saturdays, 88.5 FM, the SoCal Sound. This is Way Out West Radio Hour. Please tune in, and all shows are archived now. As always, the show on the road is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, Zach Lubitin, and we are part of the BGS Podcast Network. Stay safe, and we'll see you next week on the trail.
What's up, everybody? I am Finn McKenty, host of the Punk Rock NBA Podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. My podcast is all about doing what you love for a living, and every week I sit down and talk to people who have done exactly that. For example, musicians like Tommy from Between the Buried and Me, Matt from Periphery, Lil Lotus and Shinigami, among many others, photographers, artists, designers, YouTubers like Glenn Fricker and Sarah Dici, and I unpack exactly how they got to where they are today with the goal of helping you do the same. So if that sounds cool, you can listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com, and I'll see you there.